Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
We have biscuits at the Chatteroo today. This is a first.
We've got biscuits in honour of our two guests. Well, actually brought by one of our two guests.
Do you feel any hostility towards the guest who didn't bring the biscuits?
No, because he's my oldest friend. So we have with us Tom Baldwin and Mark Stiers. Is that the right order?
Alphabetical.
Yeah. Alphabetical.
Was there much negotiating?
No, apparently the standard practice is alphabetical, because otherwise you're going to have endless rows.
The rows would have been the opposite with both of you, wouldn't it? You'd have been, oh, well, you should go first.
We were starting that, and then my publishing wife told me what the standard practice was, and it was much relief.
Yeah, it was Tom always wins.
Who did the typing and who paced up and down?
Is
that how it goes when two people write a book together?
Pretty much. Tom types. I paste.
Okay.
There's also kind of the 35 rewrites, which means that
of the whole book. That is. So,
yeah.
Should we say for some context?
We should. The book is England: 7 Myths That Change the Country and How to Set Them Straight. And I guess the first question is: as former colleagues of Ed,
Mark was my chief speechwriter. Tom was my spin doctor.
And I wanted to know, the original idea for the book, is there some kind of support group where people meet who've worked for Ed and, you know, you share your trauma?
Informal support group.
My name is Tom and I'm 9 years clean. Yeah. It was actually a rather nice team. And most of us have stayed quite close because Ed is actually, you may have noticed, quite a nice bloke.
I like the guy.
And yeah. And I think it meant that there were some rather nice and interesting people who I met Mark through working for Ed. And I mean, we've been very good friends ever since.
I mean, not only did you meet Mark, you shared a room with each other, didn't you? We did. 4 years?
Yep, that's right. And we shared an office, and Tom insisted that the lights were never on. So my eyesight deteriorated very rapidly because Tom likes to work in the dark.
And there are other times we used to lock the door and pretend we weren't there. But that's a much longer story.
And do you think you are natural in the therapy mindset? Do you think you are natural friends and collaborators?
I mean, I think the truth is that this whole book started with the first speech that I helped you with, Ed, which was on England. And you told me that I should go round to Tom and talk to him about England.
Oh.
And we sat outside in the garden thinking about what we were going to say. And lots of the sort of original ideas for the book are in the early drafts of that speech. And I think
the early draft, but then I got rid of those bits.
What year are we talking? What year was that speech?
2011, I think. Is it 2000?
Yeah, just a run up to the Olympics, I think.
So, and that's been an ongoing.
Or 12,
yeah, that's been an ongoing conversation between the two of you since then.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those ideas. We had a lot of ideas working for it, and we had lots of different. You know, it was a very difficult election to win, and I mean, I was talking to Keir Starmer.
As we showed.
Yeah, but Keir Starmer sort of. So, yeah, like looking back at it, it's very hard to...
Tom is Keir Starmer's biographer.
Yes.
For our listeners. Available at all good book outlets.
And some bad...
Buy the England book first.
And some bad bookshops too, apparently.
Yeah.
Keir's very clear, looking back on it, Ed was trying to be a sort of change candidate, and the Tories had only been in power for a few years. Very hard to do that. And we were probably thrashing around looking for some big themes. And this speech didn't take off. And I think we sort of parked that theme for a while. But it's one that I think has returned again and again because of what's happened in the years since.
And abstracting from the history, why did you feel it was important to write a book about sort of the nation and England, not Britain, if you see what I mean?
I mean, there was a sort of remarkable coincidence, really, because I was in Australia. So after the 2015 election, I hung around for a bit and then moved to Sydney, Australia. And I was stuck there during the pandemic and probably just sort of thinking of home rather nostalgically. And I wrote an email to Tom saying, I've got an idea that we ought to write, or I ought to write a book about England, because, you know, the country's been through so much in the last few decades, and nobody seemed to know what it is anymore, and people on the left seem to hate it, and people on the right seem to have a kind of crazy idea of what it is, and I want to sort of grapple with that. And then I had an email back almost instantly from Tom saying, well, I've had almost exactly the same thought, and I've got a sort of book proposal I've put together on the idea of England. And then so we started swapping ideas backwards and forwards, and I think it is really about the trauma of that last decade or so, you know, pandemic, Brexit, austerity, it's sort of
I mean, you grew up in Wales, Mark. Mark met on our first day at Mark and I met our first day at university. Why England, not Britain?
Because I think in part because I think we thought that the England bit was the more problematic bit. You know, it was the thing that people were arguing about more.
Right.
I mean, like the Scots, you know, obviously they're still having a debate about independence, but they kind of know who they are, and the Welsh sort of know who they are. And there's probably a question, obviously, still about the union. But it felt to us, I think, that England was a question which hadn't been answered. You know, what was it, and who does it belong to, and which stories about it should you tell? That just seemed to be, you know, all kind of up in the air in politics.
I think the other side of this question is that England seemed to be the engine of quite a lot of what was happening politically over the last few years. So these different ideas of England, you know, Daniel Hannan writing his book about how we invented liberty and why it matters, that was part of what drove Brexit. Then you had this sort of global Britain myth, which was, the global Britain story, which Boris Johnson had, which is all about sort of England's buccaneering past and swash and buckle and all that nonsense. And so it felt that the dynamic of British politics was coming from within England, even though England's not a proper country in the legal sense of the words. And that sort of struggle for identity and these different stories were being inflated and engorged out of all proportion.
Is there also something in the idea that Scotland and Wales particularly have been able to define themselves as different to England under the last more than decade of conservative rule?
Yeah, I mean, they certainly the sort of nationalist side of Scotland and Wales regard them as sort of part of this England's inner empire. They were victims of England rather than, particularly Scotland, very much part of a British empire which enslaved and conquered large parts of the world.
Now, you base the book around what you call seven myths that changed a country and have to set them straight. That's the subtitle of the book. Do you want to go through the myths you chose and why?
So we wanted to try and get to the sort of point that lots of different people have been telling these sort of, as Tom said, these completely out of proportion stories about England as they try to define it. And so the way that we selected the myths really was by just making sure that we were capturing all of these sort of grandiose ideas which have dominated our politics in the last decade. So kind of we started with the obvious ones that came through Brexit, you know, sort of England invented liberty, or England now was going to be the heart of a new sort of global trading sort of empire, or that England had a moral mission which was sort of greater than other countries, and that we'd always behave better in our empire, it'd be nicer than everybody else's. So that, you know, we started with those sort of obvious myths from the right. But then we wanted to make sure that we were capturing some of the others too. So this idea that of England standing alone in the Second World War, sort of plucky people's Britain, is a sort of a kind of middle class lefty myth that people tell about England. And then also we wanted to capture this notion of, you know, some people want to do away with the past altogether. So it's a different kind of myth. It's not a historic myth, but it's the myth that England could just start again, that you could have a new England, a new Jerusalem, a kind of, you know, a world without all of the nostalgia and conservatism of tradition. And then we wanted to go right bang up to date with arguments about England, you know, in the post-Brexit era. So the arguments that we've seen about the so-called left behind working class, and then arguments also about the establishment and the attack on the establishment and culture wars. So we were trying to do a sort of waterfront of contemporary political rows about England and make sure that we caught left, right and centre in our sights.
And you tie them all to places, usually towns or cities, but for example Runnymede with Magna Carta. Did that idea come late, or did you start with a list of places?
It started with me going on a walk to Runnymede to see what Magna Carta was all about, and then realising that we could sort of describe different places, and the monumental architecture around each of them is fascinating, because Runnymede didn't really have any monuments.
When you say monumental, monuments.
So the Americans have put a monument up to Magna Carta in 1950 because Magna Carta is a huge part of their story, but we had never bothered. 2015, Cameron, who's playing games with Eurosceptics, trying to sort of position himself.
And you're very funny in this, because prior to 2015... He couldn't even define Magna Carta. David Letterman show.
No, I mean, there's somebody who presumably studied Latin at his school, which is just up the river. He didn't know, he couldn't even translate what Magna Carta was. He was beginning to inflate this myth and playing into that sort of story about an exceptional English liberty, which is, it's just nonsense. I mean, liberty or freedom presumably has existed ever since people haven't had it, because it's always been there in people's imagination. But this idea that we don't need to learn anything from continental Europe. So, you know, I went along to Runnymede and you see all these new monuments sprouting up since 2015. Suddenly it matters. Three new monuments built in, you know, just 3 or 4 years after 2015. And it felt that something was going on. And then, so I thought then maybe we could sort of begin to describe these other myths through places. So the book is kind of part travel writing, part history, and part politics. It kind of tries to hit all those themes.
And the truth is, you know, I, for much of it, I was stuck in a suburban house in Sydney in Australia, talking to Tom over Zoom and sending him ideas over email. And you know, he would get on a bus when he was allowed to out of London and sort of chat to people in all of these different places and look at those monuments with them and ask them about them. And so it was a really nice way of sort of, you know, I was living thousands of miles away with my heads in books. And Tom was sort of out and about in the country, in the places that we were talking about, chatting to real people about what they thought of these sort of crazy stories that are often written in their name.
And we obviously don't want you to pick favourites in your seven, but do you want to say, talk about one of them in a bit more depth?
I'm going to pick Plymouth because I think it's close to your heart where we end up in this anyway. In that, you know, they're fantastic stories in Plymouth, but Plymouth is obsessed with Drake. It's got, you know, the Drake Circus, it's got the Drake Shopping Centre, it's got the Drake Hall of Residence in the Drake Canteen in its university. You know, everything's called after Drake. And yet there's a sort of a sense of what does this mean to the city now? You know, Devonport and the dockyards there are still very big employers. But is Plymouth's future really going to be just about the Navy? Is Plymouth's future still going to be about, you know, going out across the Silver Sea to defend, you know, what does that mean to people? And there's, you know, there's this new debate about, you know, Drake actually being one of Britain's first slave traders. And, you know, in the museum there, they've got a new exhibition. They say Admiral, Explorer, Adventurer, Trader, Pirate and Slave Trader. And there's a woman there who is looking a bit puzzled, and she's one of the attendants. And I say, she says, are you interested in Sir Francis? I go, yeah. And she silences up and goes, oh, I don't like what they're saying about him now. I go, well, is that a bit about a slave trader? She goes, oh, I don't know about that. I just don't think it's fair to call him a pirate. And it's like in that moment, you kind of get a sense of that actually the whole bubble of this culture war debate being pricked.
Mm.
She likes the old stories. She wants to use them. But she doesn't want to be part of some sort of, are we tearing this statue down or putting the statue up and what we're saying about it? And there is a relationship with the wind and the sea that we as a country should have. We've got this very long coastline. We've got this fantastically long maritime history, which is a flawed one, and we should come to terms with that. But if we're going to have a modern relationship with the wind and the sea, rather than building more aircraft carriers, we should be doing floating wind farms. And Plymouth University is one of the best places in the world for developing this technology. So floating wind farms is actually about meeting the challenges of today, about our independence, about our security, rather than talking about the challenges of the past. And that's why I meant pick Plymouth, because I knew Ed would like it.
So how do you go about connecting that modern version of our relationship with the coast and the sea with the past, with that history? What does that look like in practice?
I think what we discovered, I think it's where perhaps we moved on from the speech that we wrote with Ed, is it's not just this idea of, you know, these big, powerful and gorgeous myths getting in the way of progress, but the actual process of deflating them, bringing them gently back to Earth, actually is quite liberating, because you then see the potential for the stories to be used in other ways. The wind and the sea should be part of England's story. It shouldn't be about us sailing off and conquering other nations. It should be about how we harness the wind and the sea to meet the challenges of today.
I mean, I think that you see that hopefully throughout the book. I mean, my if I'm choosing my favourite chapter, then it's probably the one on Oxford, which is the story about the English establishment. And what you see, you know, so much culture war at the moment, sort of, you know, trying to tear the establishment down and, you know, sort of accusing it of being sort of elite and out of touch and consumed by wokery. And, you know, when you think deeply about what Oxford means or what higher education means or what research means for the health of the country, then clearly those attacks are ridiculous. We need these established world-class institutions to help turn things around. But on the other hand, when Tom and I went to Oxford for one of our wandering around days, you know, and we both did our undergraduate degrees there. I used to teach there. They wouldn't let us into any of the buildings. You know, we turned up on a Saturday, tried to go in to have a look around and chat to the staff, and we were told that, you know, the public aren't welcome, essentially. And at that point, you say, oh, actually, you know, look, I don't want to go full Dominic Cummings here. Like, you shouldn't be tearing these institutions down. But there is something not quite right with them living in a separate world or a sort of separate universe from the rest of us. And what we try to do in that chapter, the same as in the Plymouth one, is to show that if you just gently bring this myth of the establishment back down to the ground, rather than trying to smash it up or rip it down, you come up with a real, hopefully plausible reform story. So, you know, we argue that Oxford University needs to integrate itself far more effectively than it does with its local communities. It needs to be anxious about some of the elitism that has sort of blighted it in the past. And it needs to come up with new ways of tackling those questions of diversity and inclusion in proper and fulfilling ways. And all that's doable and real. But you don't do it when you're living in mythland, either when you think they can do no wrong or you can think they do no right.
I mean, this sort of takes us to, and what Tom was saying about floating wind takes me to a sort of, takes you to a bigger question, doesn't it? Which is, or sort of an overarching question, which is, what is the purpose of these national stories? I mean, it's interesting, you know, America has the American dream as a national story / myth, you know, which is people can, you know, start off in very difficult circumstances and, you know, make make something of themselves and all that, and it's a sort of it been partly an immigrant story as well. What, I mean, I know this is a sort of rather fundamental question, but what, I mean, maybe the question is, what purpose do these national stories play, and who should tell them?
I think that's a really important question, because every community, every country needs stories. I think we saw it a bit, actually, during the pandemic, when that sense of coming together, people felt flickers of World War II, and then that sense of coming together around the NHS and hundreds of thousands of people volunteering for the NHS. The NHS didn't know what to do with them, of course. And, you know, the solution in the end, the vaccine being rolled out through rather dowdy, you know, GP surgeries and health centres, wasn't some big flashy app. It was actually something very familiar, which they understood. And that's why people queued up and there wasn't a sort of scramble for it. And it was very dignified. And I liked that about our country. It felt very English to me. And that's not about being better than anywhere else. It's just about who we are. And what we're trying to get to, and I think it's very true of politics today, is a kind of idea of ourselves which adapts to the folds and the contradictions of who we are. Like our sort of road system goes round the hills rather than straight through. Yeah, and that sort of sense of there's a real England and we need to have a politics that reflects it rather than these huge, grandiose ideas which are imposed upon it.
I mean, but what about when those things are kind of trite, you know, when we're saying, oh, what's great about our country is that we're tolerant and we've got a fantastic sense of humour. No country's going around thinking, well, we're really intolerant and we're humourless. They mean nothing apart from they do, in a sense, because these are things that people cling to.
Well, I think that there's a difficult sort of walk or dividing line between sort of triteness and reality. So I think on that point about that you just made, I mean, we talked to, or Tom talked in detail to some people who had come here from Hong Kong in our Liberty chapter, in the chapter about Runnymede and Magna Carta. And it is amazing, actually, when you ask, OK, what kind of freedom do you find in England that you were looking for, that, you know, made you come? And they don't go to the big or the grand stories. And they don't talk about sort of being able to vote in general elections, or, you know, about the, you know, history of Magna Carta or anything else like that. But people do talk about the sort of quietude of everyday life. Like they can go to the restaurant, and one of them says they can go to the restaurant with their dog. They can have something to eat, and they're not worried about being dragged out in the middle of the night by the secret police. They're not worried about people listening in on their phone calls. They're not worried about their neighbours, you know, sort of dobbing them in particular ways. And that's not quite the same as the trite version, but it's not that far off, which is that there's a sort of quiet freedom about Englishness, which is incredibly enticing to those people who've lived in authoritarian regimes.
I do get that, and I think there's an amount of privilege that goes with me being glib about that. And I think there are countries where these things are very different. But something that can sit poorly with me is a kind of an exceptionalism about us versus comparable countries. You know, I think what you've just described probably isn't that different in the Netherlands or Denmark or wherever, but we hold on to it as this bastion of Englishness.
I think the danger is to try and describe it as some form of exceptionalism. I think, you know, there are lots of places where freedom is so well established that you have the freedom to take it for granted. But the way it expresses itself is peculiarly English. So there's a story at the end of that chapter where I go to one of these new monuments, and it's a circular monument with a sort of window light, open, I don't know what to quite call it, a sort of open air thing which goes in a circle. And some light rain was falling into the reflecting pond. And there were two women there.
Where was this?
This was in Runnymede.
Yeah.
And I go in there with my son, who found this whole conversation incredibly awkward. He gave me 2 out of 10 for social skills at the end of this. And I go, oh, so you're interested in Magna Carta? And they look at me as if I'm mad. And they go, we're from Feltham. We'd like to take the dogs for a walk. And I went, so what about this monument? Do you like this monument? And he went, well, we had to drive from Feltham. And you realise you're in completely cross purposes. And there's this long, awkward silence. And eventually one of the other women says, still, it's nice and peaceful here, isn't it? And it felt to me like that sense of being bored on a drizzly Sunday afternoon at a National Trust monument is as close a definition to freedom as I can get. And it's going to be different to the Netherlands, not necessarily worse or better, but that is, to me, what English freedom is, rather than the idea that we invented it and the rest of the world needs to learn from us.
Yes.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
So last year, Tony Blair did a conversation with Michael Sheen, which for the New Statesman, and he said, my idea was to take what I think are the enduring best qualities of Britain. This is what he tries to do when he was Prime Minister. Take the enduring best qualities of Britain. What I think are the enduring best qualities of Britain: open-mindedness, tolerance, innovation, and try to give Britain a different narrative that would allow it to think its best days are ahead of it. Now that's saying the role for politicians is to take these elements of nation and give people a sense of give people a sense of optimism and hope about the country's future. Is that do you think that is the role of politicians in relation to these questions of national?
I mean, I guess my sense nation. Is that if it is, well, I'll come back to the if it is, but if it is, they need to do it better by and large. So what we found, I think, one of the reasons we love writing the book is in all these conversations we've had with people from completely different walks of life, and you know, some famous and some not famous, and some left wing and some right wing, and some young and some old. It was like we had extraordinarily like beautiful and rich and funny and telling stories when we were sort of off the record chatting to folks on Zoom. And then when you got people into their sort of professional political mode so often, the kind of beauty would dissipate, you know, and it would become much more just sort of, you know, kind of cliched or abstract or jargon filled or perhaps too grandiose. And at that point, the, you know, sort of normal non-political folks just sort of raise an eyebrow and say, oh my goodness, that, you know, that's not the country. So I think one of the things we were trying to do in the book is say, look, if politicians want to reflect back to the country what they are proud of and what they're excited about, they need to do it in a way which is honest and authentic to the actual stories of the country. And I think in the Blair quote there says a lot in a way, which is, you know, as soon as he gets into the describing of what it is that he's proud of, it just becomes like big conceptual abstraction rather than the sort of muddly, messy, quirky, you know, sort of particular stuff, which is actually what we talk about when we talk about England. And so, you know, that's what we're trying to get at.
Isn't that so hard, though? Because, I mean, he's trying to tell a complex story of national character, in inverted commas, in a way that is comprehensible.
Yeah.
Well, I think this is, you're almost explaining the difference between Tony Blair and Keir Starmer here, in that Keir Starmer, I've interviewed a lot of times for this other book I've done. I think it's someone
organic
who,
plug, as they say on Positive
America. Well, it's Keir Starmer, the biography. I think he's someone that instinctively understands the complexity of the problems facing us and the kind of solutions. He instinctively actually recoils from being a kind of capital P politician, which is all about straight lines, dividing lines, grand visions, quick sound bites about your policy pledges. It is a muddle. It is going to be complex. But in the nuance and ambiguity are little pockets of space where you can form new consensus. If you have a straight line, they're the enemy, these are our friends, then I don't think you really get forward as a country.
This is a sort of maybe unexpected development here of the way this conversation is going. But to be fair to Tony Blair,
I've never heard you say
that. You have, actually. He was trying to fashion an idea of a new Britain to give people a sense that, of a sort of future. Just to push back a little bit, saying everything's complex and messy and so on, it's fine, but it's not very sort of usable.
I think it has to be the genuine, with that, again, without using too many cliche, it has to be the people's future. It can't be a future which is pushed upon people. It has to be a future that comes out of genuinely the best and the most exciting and the most optimistic aspects of everyday people's everyday lives. Because otherwise it looks like it's manufactured and it's fake and it's distant from
the Millennium Dome.
And that's what our chapter on the Millennium Dome is precisely about, this, which is that, yes, everyone was longing for excitement and optimism and newness in the late 1990s, early 2000s, but they also wanted it to reflect aspects of their lives which they thought too often, politicians or big businesses or others just forgot.
And in the muddle is actually a solution.
But politicians can't say it's all a big muddle.
Well, they can to some extent, because I think if politicians are constantly expected to fit the template of what a politician is meant to be. And I think you sometimes suffered from this, in that you were meant, we did that speech once. If you want someone who looks great in photo opportunities and does policy,
this is becoming a therapy session, not in a good way.
I mean, Ed is clearly someone who's in politics for the right reasons, who's got really good ideas, but because he doesn't fit, the media didn't get it. And I think the same, actually, that there's a battle now between a genuinely decent guy in Keir Starmer who wants to change his country, recognises that some of that change isn't particularly going to be dazzling or headline gathering. It's going to be rather boring, piecemeal work, dealing with this nuance, dealing with that ambiguity. And then you get some progress rather than doing some big fancy speech, which doesn't change anything once the applause has died away.
I guess what I'm trying to ask is, how do you make it a sort of, at least take the Tony Blair example, because he was trying to use a version of a national story to tell a story about the future. You're saying it's a bit too simplistic, maybe.
I guess
it goes to the question of how these national stories can be useful. Maybe they're not one unifying story. Maybe it's a story about Plymouth and its future and floating wind, or a story about, I don't know, other stories which are more piecemeal.
I think the starting point, I guess my instinct is that you've got to start with the real in order to build the better. And that's what great stories do. I mean, here we're in the studio, here we're surrounded by fantastic books about music and British pop music in the 1960s, 1970s. And all of those incredible songs that we still remember, Beatles or Stones or what have you, are unbelievably magical, but they're also grounded in everyday experience, often everyday working class suburban experience. And then they build from that beautifully textured, nuanced view of the real world to something which is profoundly romantic. And that's what great political conversation, I think, should do too.
But maybe there's a different, maybe it's just, maybe the answer to this is don't look for the holy grail of telling this story which fits in. Just celebrate what's good about the country. Yeah. I mean, that's a sort of more simple...
That's a great way of putting it.
Yeah. ...thought, which is just celebrate the good things about, creative industries, the Premier League, NHS, great institutions, great things that we have. You don't need to then fit it into this very sort of...
Totally, totally. Or make stuff up. You don't need to make stuff up. You know, you can tell incredibly... And we know that people actually think like this. We did some polling. I run a think tank and we did a UCL. And we did some polling recently on, what do people want to hear about the past? And they want to hear complex stories. They don't want to hear simplistic stories. Despite the fact that on social media or in sort of culture war land, you'll have like really simplistic stories about whether England was wonderful or awful. That's not what most people want to hear. They want to hear the twists and the turns. And if you start from that, then I think you can still have inspiration and excitement. In fact, I think you have more inspiration and excitement once you start from something which is actually recognisably real.
Just one thing, sorry, Tom wants to come in. I'm sorry. But I'm always very struck that America has its National Day, July the 4th. France has its National Day, July the 14th. I don't know whether Australia presumably does have a National Day.
It does, but a huge row about it because it's the day that the settlers arrived.
We don't have that kind of national day. We've had royal jubilees and so on, but it's not been the same. And I think that I think that is peculiar. We have St. George's Day.
Yes, but it's not a bank holiday.
Exactly. And that's what I mean.
There are no traditions.
That's what I mean.
That go along.
It's this with week.
St. George's Day.
Yeah.
I don't think a national day is going to solve this country's problems.
One thing is going to...
And that's the point. I think we've had this era where people have come up with grandiose ideas and three-word slogans. Yeah, modernise or die, not the few, strong and stable, take back control, get Brexit done. How are they working out? Right? I don't think they're doing this country any favours.
Yeah.
I don't think they are what this country's about. I think it's quite good we don't actually have a single national day. We have lots of days where we celebrate different things.
But let me push back against that, Tom. The reaction to the opening ceremony of the Olympics was incredibly positive. All that was really doing was celebrating good things about our country, mm-hmm. right? But we don't have that.
And as you say in the book, it's this sort of basket case of an event as well, in that it was real kitchen sinky. And I think there's
Did you have that reaction? I didn't know you then.
Yeah, I thought it was wonderful, but I loved how insane it would have looked to the world as well. And, I think the idea of like English eccentricity is overplayed and a bit annoying in these ways. But I think that the complexity of Englishness was what made that opening ceremony so great. And I think you can draw a line from that opening ceremony to the support for the NHS you talked about. And I'm always encouraged by the fact that the NHS is a new institution. It's not Shakespeare. It's not a list of Tudor kings and queens. It's something that's beloved, that is in living memory. And it's become part of the fabric and the identity over a relatively short space of time as well.
And if you contrast the Olympic opening ceremony with the Millennium Domes opening ceremony, which got a gigantic raspberry because it was about a big idea but also nothing. It was a great abstraction about young country, new country, but there's nothing really in it. And so the Olympic ceremony was a muddle. It had a cacophony of different stories, and it felt more like us.
Mm.
Now, I think there's something to build out of that. I don't think we built out of that properly. We had the ceremony and that went away. And then we went back to rowing with each other. But there is a sense that the solutions that we've got need to look more like the NHS, which is a bit lumpy, which is a bit ramshackle, but it's loved because it feels like us. It feels like it's ours. And everybody has a different story about the NHS. It's not one story.
You're both from the left of politics. Presumably part of the point of this book is to say to the left, take England seriously, get over the, all of the kind of hang-ups, and don't sort of shy away from talking about, maybe patriotism, maybe England, maybe both.
Yeah, we spotted very early on as we started writing that we've got lots of friends who although English and living in England and doing fine, sort of hate the place, or at least hate the stories they get told about the place. So,
Do they hate the place?
Well, I mean, they certainly hate the manifestations of it. So, you know, people who as soon as there is a kind of royal event, they get incredibly angry and start sending nasty Facebook posts.
We've allowed the right to tell the stories.
Yeah, exactly. Or Tom had a friend who won't walk in the countryside because of all the pastoral myths that people tell about it, you know. And our instinct was like, look, I can understand that your hostility to some of those right-wing myths of the country and how annoying they are, and the exceptionalism we were talking about before, it's kind of ridiculous. And of course England didn't invent liberty, and of course we didn't have a moral empire. It's just stupid. But throwing England away as a result of that, as Tom says, gifts the whole country to the right, and that's just a terrible thing to do. And then I think we thought, okay, so let's look at some of the ways that the left talks about the country when they do. And some of that we found wanting still, and that was obviously, you know, we found that when we were writing way back in the 2012, 2011 when we started this, is that there are like left wing myths of England, but some of them are just like a little bit unpersuasive too, like, you know, everything connects to the English Civil War and the Levellers and then the Tolpuddle Martyrs, and you know that's such a small story of what the country is. So
yeah. I mean, maybe that's partly though what you're hitting on in and Tom's thing about complexity, which is, there's lots in the national story for people to take out the bits that they like, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, as long as you don't overblow it.
Yeah, as long as you don't claim the thing that you've taken out is the only story to tell. I think that was, in a way, our takeaway is that every single one of these myths is blown out of all proportion by people who think they can get some benefit from doing so.
Oh, I see.
And as they do that, they insult the rest of us and they leave most people cold.
It's just, I mean, Orwell, in that famous description in The Lion and the Unicorn, he talked about, you know, the lorries going on the A1 up north, the clatter of clogs on the cobbles in Wigan, the old maid cycling through the mist. Yeah, and these are all different sights and sounds. They're not one story. It's what makes a country is actually that muddle. And in the muddle, it's not just saying, oh, it's a muddle. Is there's some organic genius in it, which is all the better for coming from a muddle, because it takes account of all these different influences. What we're trying to get away from is a single national story, straight lines, and recognise that necessarily it's more human, more interesting, better for it to be curves bending into the folds of the landscape and the people.
When you're living overseas, in your case Australia, how does that change your view of the stories we tell about ourselves? I was talking to a friend of mine the other day who lived in the States for a while and then came back into Heathrow and saw a huge display of a beefeater with open arms. Thinking, what is this country? I've seen that 100 times and never thought anything about it. But, you know, having been away for so long, you thought, this isn't representative of life. And yet this is the thing we're choosing. Now, of course, there's playing up to tourism or international visitors in this way. But is this stuff?
Why has a beefeater got open arms? He's a security guard. Welcome to the Tower of London.
Yeah. Yeah. Is this stuff that struck you as strange?
I mean, it's just so much to say, but I think the most telling story I have about, you know, being away and being back is, you know, I was in Australia for just under 5 years and came back, and I was nervous about coming back because I've got an 8-year-old daughter, and you know, so she was young and she had an amazing life in Australia. It was, you know, sunny and you were at the beach every morning and, you know, sort of, you know, just gorgeous sort of lifestyle. And I thought, oh, we're going to come back to London and it's going to be really hard, and how's she going to cope and what's it going to be like? And then she went for her first day. She's at a primary school in Hackney where we live, and she went in for her first day at school. And she came back more full of energy and of life and of spirit than I've ever seen her in her entire life. And I was like, well, what is it? What are you loving so much? You know, why aren't you depressed by the drizzle? It was two things, you know, she said. Yeah, first of all, and this is a great thing about East London, it was the diversity. She'd met people who'd come from all over the world who spoke different languages at home. They were telling stories. They were laughing. They expected her to speak Australian. And she was just blown away by the creativity that comes from having that kind of classroom. You don't get that in Australia. And then the second thing is that she was blown away by people telling, and this is true, I'm not making this up just to sell books, but by telling ordinary stories about England. I mean, the school life in Hackney was full of references to, you know, things like you saw in the opening ceremony. They were chatting about the NHS. They were going on school trips to the Tower of London. They were talking about the Beatles. There were pictures all over the wall of Idris Elba, who's a local hero at their school. And there was a kind of cultural pride in what I think of as everyday Englishness, which, again, is not present in Australia. And when she was telling me all these things, gabbling away, I was thinking, oh, that is why I am actually ultimately happy to be home, because for all of the problems that we've got as a country, yeah, our ability to be genuinely diverse, genuinely creative, and tell complex, rich stories about who we are, you know, came across to a small girl in her London primary school.
Good note to end on.
Yeah.
What's the sequel?
England 2.
Some of more myths.
Are you going to do another book together?
I don't know.
I would love to. It was fantastically good fun to write, but it did take a lot out of us.
You began the conversation by asking if there's a self-help group for former Miliband aides. There's also something called Writers Anonymous, which is when people gather together and say, you know, I haven't written a word for 2 years, but I'm worried I might start again. Because it's a very painful process. But I hope if people do buy this book, they enjoy it, because a lot of work and thought went into it. And
much love.
Yeah.
Tom and Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you for having
us. Thank you for coming on the chat room.
Thank you for the biscuits.
Yeah.
Tom.
Mark just brought friendship.